This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Busy show today on the 27th day of April, and we start with Mike Shepherd, the man who heads the Louisiana Music Hall of Fame, and he has produced a book with many of the stalwarts who are in that great shrine, and he has been around for a little while in the music business. And you're the guy who made all this happen as far as a Hall of Fame. If you go to the Baton Rouge Airport, you can see the kiosk standing tall and proud right in the middle. I know that was something you worked very hard on, and you have obviously put a lot of time into this book. Tell us about Shepherding the Music, Mike Shepherd.
Well, I want to say first, I didn't come up with the name. I got to thank Del Moon for that.
All right. Okay.
That's some of Del's humor. But, Del was sort of the first founder in 1979, 1980. Worked with me. He didn't make it. He failed. I brought it back in the early 2000s, and Del signed on as a board member.
Now, how many members are there?
I'd say 250, 260.
All right. So you're increasing as we speak, and through the years there have been some auspicious ceremonies, and some of these people who have been honored in great places around the world, they take it to heart.
They do. I'm very happy when I see the plaque, the award, in a picture in somebody's house, Jerry Lee Lewis's house, Tim McGraw's house. It says, well, they meant enough to them to take it home and put it on their wall in a good place.
Well, you have many of the concerts that you were involved with that are featured in your book. And back in the day, Baton Rouge and New Orleans were really must-go-to places when people were on tour. The casinos have kind of changed that, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. And what sort of ran me out of the business in the 70s was the corporate tourism. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm looking at some of the people who have been to our great city. Creedence Clearwater Revival was here June 11th, I'm not sure, the year 1969. You booked that show, didn't you?
Oh,
Independence
yeah.
Hall, right?
I am seated. I ran it. It was mine.
John Fogerty. That was right around the time of Down on the Corner. The Beach Boys were at the Parker Coliseum on April 18th that year.
You checked the other two acts on that? That was LSU did that and asked me to come in and run it.
Who were the other acts?
The Strawberry Alarm Clock, which is very big.
Incense and Peppermint, yeah, number
and
one.
The Buffalo Springfield,
and
one of the
Stephen
best.
Stephen Stills, who went to LSU. Did you know that?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, for what it's worth. Donovan, I'm just going down the list, and Jimi Hendrix. Jimi Hendrix was in Baton Rouge on July 30th, 1968.
For a rare two-show night.
And where did he perform?
At Independence Hall.
What kind of reception was there?
It was a good reception. They loved him.
Well, I imagine so. But, you know, I remember having Mickey Dolenz on this show, Mike, many years ago, the Monkees, and he said Jimi Hendrix once opened for the Monkees around the country.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that?
And I imagine they reciprocated at some point.
But you've rubbed shoulders with some of the great musicians, some from Louisiana, some from other parts of the country, and even some from abroad. Herman's Hermits, they were here. The Guess Who? From Canada. Independence Hall, what kind of a venue was that? I never had the pleasure of attending a concert there.
It belonged to the White House Inn Hotel.
On the river, right?
On the river.
Yeah.
On Front Street, which is real close to the river.
And here is Bob Hope, the Bob Hope, November 17th, 1972. 6 days after LSU lost 35-21 to Alabama and Bear Bryant, Woody Dumas is giving Bob Hope the key to the city, made him an honorary citizen of Baton Rouge.
And the music part of that show was, it wasn't just Bob Hope. He never sang. But
he did sing, remember? Thanks for the memory.
Well, that's, yeah.
All right, but
The main act was the Temptations, the original Temptations.
They were with
five
Bob
microphones.
They were with Bob Hope.
Yeah.
At the Assembly Center, right? I think it was at the LSU Assembly Center.
Yeah, that was a thrill for me to be mixing the sound and bring up da 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 until the crowd went crazy.
877-217-5757. The book is Shepherding the Music. It is a beautiful book, by the way. And on the cover, you have many of the Louisiana luminaries. Of course, you would have Satchmo, Nat King Cole, Louis Armstrong, and I see Percy Sledge. You've got the hardback copy there that's even more beautiful.
I wanted you to see this, Jim.
Yeah, it is magnificent. Jimmy Davis. He is on the Aaron Neville. I could go down. It's a Hall of Fame group. Jerry Lee Lewis. I see Pete Fountain. And, of course, Al Hurt, who died 22 years ago today.
Yes.
Al Hurt. Next year will be his 100th birthday.
I hadn't looked it up, but you may be right.
And he was inducted in the Hall of Fame at Chris Owen's place posthumously in 2009.
Were you there, Jim?
I was there.
I thought so.
I was there on his 87th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And Al Hurt, 1964, I believe, just, 57 years ago. Remember, he had a pretty big hit. Matt Doyle is at the ready on Al's death day. Here is Jumbo. That's good stuff. Listener reminds us that Al Hurt also did the theme from The Green Hornet.
Yeah, he did, which was a very difficult piece, but for Al, that was nothing.
Well, it's kind of sad, like the Assembly Center, when I was in school, our yearbooks, and we don't even have yearbooks anymore, at least not bound copies, but they would be filled with all these great acts that had come through Baton Rouge and LSU when I was there for all 4 years, and that has changed immensely, and it is a bit perturbing.
It was a great time back then, and a lot was happening in music all over the place, especially in Louisiana, where it came from.
877-217-5757. Listener, before we go to the phone line, says, are there any females on the cover? You got a few.
We have Irma. I see Mahalia over there.
And Irma and Mahalia are two pretty big ones. We had Irma not so long ago, and she's still doing it. And we got time for a call or two. Dominic in Grand Coteau. Dominic, you're on with Mike Shepherd. Hi, Dominic. Good morning to you. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning, men, and congratulations on your book there, Mr. Shepherd.
Thank you.
I've got a question. Is there anything about the battle over Clifton Chenier's accordion with his son, CJ? Did you touch on any of that in there?
I didn't put that in the book because it's in litigation. They're fighting over it, CJ and the family of Clifford.
Well, also on the cover, thank you. Appreciate the call, as always, from Dominic, but is Johnny Rivers, who was born on the same day as Al Hurt, by the way, November 7th. He was born on Al's 20th birthday. Johnny Rivers is almost 80 years old. Isn't that something?
Well, a lot of my friends are almost 80 years old. I'm almost 80 years old.
And he's still doing it.
And Clifton is on the cover, by the way.
He is, I know. And so is John Fred, who would have been 80 years old next month, I believe May the 8th, 1941.
My old roommate, and I promised Fred when he was in the hospital in New Orleans, bound to die, I told him I was doing the Hall of Fame, and he was going to be the first inductee. He was.
Well, as he should have been. He had a number one. You know, Bruce Springsteen's never had a number one, but John Fred did. And he not only performed it, he wrote it, Judy in Disguise. And on May the 8th, he will have been born 80 years ago in Baton Rouge. And at the time, he was big, and he and Johnny Rivers were in school together at one point.
I assume they were.
They were, yeah.
People tell me Johnny was never in school.
Well, Johnny, I don't think ever graduated from high school. He went to a few of them, got kicked out of one or two, but he still has an affinity for Baton Rouge High. He actually had a fundraiser there a few years ago, so he hasn't forgotten his old homestead on Convention Street. Born in New York City, but Johnny Ramostella grew up on Convention Street.
Yep.
And Mike Shepherd, you've known just about all of these people. Who are some of those most memorable ones that you've known who are featured in shepherding the music.
Well, of course, Fred was one of them.
Yeah.
A dear friend of mine was Alan Toussaint. Alan was probably the nicest man you'll ever meet.
Really?
He is really a gentleman.
A listener asked about Buddy Guy. Do you know Buddy very well?
Not very well, but I knew him.
And he's, of course, another one. Worked as a janitor at Pleasant Hall. Isn't that something? The great Buddy Guy.
Well, I had a great helper on that show, too, Mr. Kip Holden.
Mr. Kip Holden. Okay. Well, the book is Shepherding the Music from Mike Shepherd. For those who would like a copy, where?
Go to my website, LouisianaMusicHallOfFame.org.
LouisianaMusicHallOfFame.org. That's the Green Hornet from Al Hurt. And as we go to the break, thank you, Mike. Keep going, and we'll talk soon. And we'll be back with a look at the finances of our country. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. A few minutes with Amin Walker of First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. You hear that name at the beginning and close of the show. He is a financial supporter of Talk Louisiana, but he knows his taxes. And right now, President Biden, as the New York Times has reported in its pages over the last week, will seek new taxes on the rich, including a near doubling of the capital gains tax for people earning more than $1 million a year to pay for the next phase of a $4 trillion plan to reshape the American economy. The president will also propose raising the top marginal tax rate to 39.6% from 37%, the level it was cut to under President Trump's overhaul in 2017. And the proposals are in line with Biden's campaign promises to raise taxes on the wealthy, but not on households earning less than $400,000 a year. This is something that, if with our debt as it is and our deficit, is obviously necessary, but people don't like to pay taxes, including the rich. But there is a perception, I mean, Walker, that this is going to hit everybody. Is that an accurate perception?
Absolutely. I mean, the one thing that I hear from my clients the most is, how's this going to affect me? He's raising taxes as soon as he gets in. But, you know, the truth of the matter is this is going to affect very few people.
So very few.
It is. You know, when you talk about the capital gains, and, you know, those are only, first of all, long-term capital gains that are affected, which are those that are over a year. But, you know, the interesting thing is, when you look at capital gains and you look at the taxes associated with them, you know, that most of the people are not affected for the sheer fact that most people's stock is in their 401ks and IRAs, and those are not affected no matter what income you make. So we're just really talking about the private investors that are, you know, making more than $1 million a year just in capital gains income. We're not talking about overall income.
And as we know, even in the COVID age, there are people who made a lot of money in the market. And people like Elon Musk made
billions
is an understatement. Sure. Jeff Bezos, yeah, they mm-hmm. really cleaned up during the COVID age. And the stock market went up after going down precipitously. It came back up, and he invested at the right time. Last year was an exceptionally good year to be in the market if you did it right. Now, of course, you invested at the wrong time. It was terrible. If you pulled your money out as it went down for the count and then didn't get back in time, it was not a good year, and that's the way the market often runs. But capital gains, according to this proposal, as I read the summary in the New York Times, would also be subject to a 3.8% surtax that helps fund the Affordable Care Act. How would that work?
And that is actually something that is in effect right now. So right now, capital long-term capital gains for those making those large amounts of money are flat 20%. But there's already the 3.8% Medicare surtax on that. So that is additional monies that's paid in, as you said, for the Obamacare plan. And so, you know, when you're looking at the new taxes, you're talking about raising the marginal tax rate on capital gains from 20% all the way up to 39.6, and then they have the additional 3.8. So, you know, that makes it 40.4, and right now they're paying 23.8. So,
I recall when President Clinton took office, the national debt was at about $4 trillion, and people were alarmed by that. That was 28 years ago. And Clinton, he erased the deficit, actually had surpluses the last few years of his presidency and one into the first year of George Bush. And then, of course, Bush had tax cuts and wars that caused the debt to skyrocket. And we have not returned from deficit spending since. And now the U.S. national debt, I mean, Walker, it has actually a clock showing it moving as we speak, is at $28,220,000,000,000. $28 trillion. It was $4 trillion 28 years ago, and people were concerned. It's $28 trillion now, and people are yawning. Why are we not as concerned as we were a generation ago?
You know, I think we've become numb to it. I think now the number is just so big that it's not even a real number for anyone anymore. You know, we have become a society that lives strictly on what can I get right now, what can I do right now, and don't think about the future. We'll figure out a way to pay for it later. You know, all of the last three stimulus packages that they've put out were very important for what was going on in the economy. And we were, you know, we were so wrapped up in COVID and people being out of work and restaurants closed and that sort of thing that, you know, we just said, let's figure out a way to get some money in people's hand now. We'll figure out how to pay for it later.
All right. Well, the cost per person, that's every man, woman, and child, if we were to pay off the U.S. national debt in the U.S. today, $85,383. So and the cost per taxpayer, $224,748. And that shows also the fact that we have fewer than half the people in the United States who are actually paying taxes. Now,
correct.
Some people are kids, some people are retired, and some people avoid taxes. And that's not just people at the bottom rung of the ladder. As we know, people at the top rung. And what about those who say no matter what they do as far as tinkering with the numbers, as far as percentages, there are still going to be people who can game the system?
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, you know, this what we're talking about in terms of capital gains tax, that's harder to game the system because, you know, unless you're going to buy stock in every child's name that you know, for instance, to keep you, you know, report the income under them. You know, that's still passive income, so they're going to have to pay some taxes on it. But, you know, there aren't very many ways to game the system of capital gains. But, I mean, you know, where you hear people doing, for instance, Trump only owing $1,500, you know, he just probably showed a tremendous amount of losses in his business, so had no liability. You can't do the same thing with gains.
Well, and some people have an easier time showing losses than others. And some people, of course, end up having to answer questions in court about tax maneuvering. But this is a case in which we have huge debt and we're spending more trying to get out of the COVID hole. And the president of the United States is trying to find a way to foot part of the bill by hitting those who have benefited the most. Why is that something that is so offensive to some people?
Well, I'll try to hold my thoughts here. But, you know, when you, first of all, you have to look at who's supporting these bills and who is not supporting these bills. Now, it's not exactly bipartisan like it always has been. There are some Democrats that are raising some cane against it. But typically, you know, the Republican Party has always, you know, been a party of the wealthy. Their supporters are the wealthy. They themselves are wealthy in Congress.
And most Democrats in Congress are wealthy, too.
And those are the ones that are pushing back the most because this is the one that's going to affect them and their main supporters and donors and constituents. You know, the normal person who's informed says, well, I mean, if you make $1 million worth of just gain on your stocks mm-hmm. in a year, you know, it shouldn't hurt you to pay $430,000 worth of taxes on it. But, you know, the people who are actually passing mm-hmm. the laws are the ones that are putting up the fight.
How does a guy like President Biden, who is 78 years old and, to my knowledge, has never had a job outside of government, how does he have any knowledge about how the real world works?
Well, I mean, he's lived in it and done politics for a very long time. So,
is that the same, though?
It's probably not the same. But, you know, again, you have to look for creative ways to fix this problem and to, you know, pay for these different programs that have happened. And, you know, I think his intentions are good in terms of wanting to make mm-hmm. sure that it's the wealthier people that are giving the larger share.
And I mentioned last week, and a listener asked me to repeat it. Actually, I mentioned it yesterday that last week there was a vote on equal pay for men and women, and the U.S. House passed it. Mm-hmm. But in Louisiana, Julia Letlow voted against it. Garrett Graves voted against it. Clay Higgins voted against it. Mike Johnson voted against it. Steve Scalise voted against it. They don't want a law saying we have to have equal pay for men and women.
Well, you know, and the argument is always, how do we actually measure that? And, you know, that's what they're using for the excuse.
For the same job.
For the same job.
That's correct. What the law said, for the same job. And that's pretty specific.
It is, until you start factoring in time on the job. And
well, you know, yeah, there are always ways to kill the bill.
Exactly. And that's what they're looking for, is ways to kill it.
The ways to kill it, because they don't want another law. But on the other hand, depending, the most ambitious report shows that women make 82 cents on the dollar that men do for the same job. And that's right. The most ambitious. There are others that show significantly less than that.
Exactly.
But it's always good to catch up with you, Amin Walker. Let's do it again soon. And thanks for catching up. Amin Walker of First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. We'll be back, things go according to plan, with Drew Harrell of The Washington Post after this time out for the news on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle is producing, and we're joined from the Beltway by Drew Harrell of The Washington Post. He is the technology reporter of renown there. He's been with the Post for 7 years, and it was The Washington Post that originally started calculating the number of falsehoods stated by the former United States President, Donald John Trump, and, of course, it got into the thousands, and when I say thousands, we're talking many thousands. I think maybe even Drew lost count. But is this unique to President Trump, or do all presidents tend to mislead the American people on occasion?
It's a good question. Every president has fibbed a little, right? I mean, we're not naive enough to expect that any president it swears by the truth every day. I actually just looked it up. I'm glad you asked the question. We counted 30,573 misleading claims.
Okay, you faded out on 30,500 and what?
30,573 false or misleading claims.
Okay, now some people just call them lies, and of course the media have been castigated for terming it a lie, because if somebody tells you a falsehood and they believe it, then that might not be a lie. But in some cases, these were whoppers, pants on fire things, weren't they?
Yeah, many of them were whoppers. Many of them were outright lies, and we can say that because, you know, we know the president knew the truth because he had said the truth another day and then deployed a lie when convenient. But 30,000, I mean, these just span the gamut of everything from, you know, by the end of it, talking about voter fraud, to even the first days of the presidency. So this was, you know, a signature of the 4 years of the Trump era. And, you know, it's going to be something we're thinking about for a long time, how it shaped the country and the White House.
Did this contribute to what happened on January 6th?
I think it certainly did. I mean, thinking back to that day when there were massive riots, you know, down the street from me here at the Capitol, a lot of the people went directly from President Trump's rally, where he was saying he had been unfairly punished by this vast conspiracy of voter fraud, and kind of sent people on their way to the Capitol. So many of those people told us that they were encouraged by the president. They believed they had, you know, his direct encouragement to, you know, storm Congress and tell them to put the right guy in. So, you know, I think there is a direct line between how they acted in the real world and the words that President Trump was saying, not just in real life, but on Twitter and on TV, just sort of building up this lie to get people to do what he wanted.
Well, the president perfected the art of saying something that was disagreeable to him as being fake news, and yet a lie by its essence is fake news. How are we going to get past this now, in which if something is something we don't agree with, we just don't say it's real, it's fake?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good question. And, you know, I don't want to put it all on President Trump, because there's a bigger issue here, which is just that there's a general distrust of, you know, not just the media, but institutions at large. We saw this during the pandemic, and now with the vaccine rolling out, people distrusting, you know, the medical establishment and the vaccines and that kind of thing. You know, social media has definitely made this harder, because it's very easy for a lie to travel around the world and encourage people to maybe think things against their real interest, including about vaccines and voter fraud and that kind of thing. So, you know, I think as the internet becomes a bigger part of our lives and as there becomes this greater force from people who don't have our best interests at heart, who are lying to our faces, we just need to be, you know, and this is something that people on the left, right, and center should all be doing, which is just that thinking twice about believing whatever we see on the internet, and maybe kind of checking ourselves to make sure that we're not just going along with the thing that makes us feel the biggest emotion, mm-hmm. the most outrage, but really kind of validating our prior instances, and maybe, you know, sometimes correcting ourselves when we get it wrong.
877-217-5757 is your number for Drew Harrell, of the technology reporter and editor of the Washington Post, and 30,573 lies calculated by former President Donald John Trump in his 4 years in office. How in the world were you able to get it down to that number?
Well, there's a big team at the Post, not including me, but many reporters, fact checkers, editors who over the years did the very grueling work of listening to every speech and every utterance, every tweet from the president, and really sort of checking him down. So there wasn't, you know, every time, you know, he said a lot of lies, and sometimes they were repeated. So it was a matter of kind of distinguishing which are new and which are, but, you know, he often played the same songs, right? It often had to do with, you know, the economy and COVID and tax cuts and voter fraud. And all of these were kind of, you know, he had his way of weaponizing information to sort of back his side. But it took just a lot of listening to his speeches over the years and really going back to check the facts and saying, okay, what do we know? What do we have certainty over? And what is just sort of total gibberish?
All right. Doug on Nicholson, I believe. Doug, you're on Talk Louisiana. Hi, Doug.
Good morning. I think you've raised, you and your guests have both raised the key point here, which is that in addition, just the sheer number of falsehoods and lies that the former president told continually, 24/7, it seemed like, you could single out the ones that what they were about was also unique. Telling the country, when he knew this virus to be deadly and highly contagious, that they had it under control and that it was going to disappear, which were said numerous times, might be the most egregious out of those 30,000, arguably.
That arguably did more harm in the president, based on the conversation with your colleague, Bob Woodward, numerous conversations. He knew better.
Mm-hmm. He did. You know, in this time last year, he, like the caller said, he was saying, like a miracle, one day it'll be gone. How many months were we losing time and losing potential lives to sort of inaction in Washington? That's the story that we're just starting to really be able to uncover. You know, you have to see more than 500,000 dead in the U.S. from COVID, as the virus has already mm-hmm. killed more than 3 million around the world. You know, and the weight and the confusion over masks and vaccines and, you know, shutdown orders. We can all remember this time last year, how confusing it was and how big of a void, really, and federal leadership there was. And so, you know, I think President Trump, former President Trump, is still trying to kind of correct the record and make it seem like, you know, he was the solid unitary force behind the vaccine and Operation Warp Speed was kind of the miracle worker. But, you know, I think a lot of us have long enough memories to remember that, you know, he was very obstructive in terms of, you know, supporting the vaccine in the first place. So, you know, I think the damage of that is very subtle, and it plays mm-hmm. out on kind of a person-to-person level. And
all right. Ellen in Sherwood. Ellen, you're on with Drew Harrell of The Washington Post. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. I appreciate your being on and talking about this, because we really need to remember.
All right. What is your question?
I just wanted to echo the previous caller that Trump took lying to a whole new level. And of course, all politicians lie, but he just lied for 4 straight years.
All right. Does Joe Biden lie, Drew?
I think he probably does. And we're just, you know, in the start of his presidency, I'm sure he's going to be saying fibs. And that's why it's important that we reporters look at him just with as much scrutiny as we did President Trump. But I would be surprised, seeing the pattern as we've had, that he would be anywhere near as consistently false as President Trump. I mean, President Trump, you know, exceeded Democrats and Republicans He was the Whopper King, and so a lot would have to change in the Biden era for him to even come close to that level.
Just doing the math, if he told 30,573 lies over 4 years, then that's well over 7,000 a year. So that would be numerous lies every day of every year. So it is a big bar for anyone to try to equal. Jim and Walker. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. Why don't we talk about Donald Trump's outright theft from his supporters when opt-out emails were sent for campaign contributions, which turned into weekly draws of upwards to $500 or more every single week from his supporters until their accounts were drained.
All right. It was a fundraising mechanism for the former president to go before the masses and stir them up and sometimes, in your judgment and others, not tell the truth.
Yeah, it was, and you know, the specific instance he's talking about, there was a fairly scammy sort of email blast where you'd have to jump through all these hoops to stop paying, you know, regularly into the Trump campaign fund. It was a mess, and you know, it was the kind of sort of deceptive thing you don't really want to see from any political campaign, left, right, or center. But
all right, Dan downtown, you're on with Drew Harrell of the Washington Post. Dan, good morning.
Morning. That so many buy into Trump's lies, including a majority of Louisiana voters, constitute an indictment of our educational system?
Do many people really care, and did they know that there were this many lies, those who are not reading the Washington Post, Drew?
You know, I'm not smart enough to be able to say whether it's an indictment of the education system. I can see that our information system, how we talk, is kind of fundamentally broken right now, right? I mean, it's very hard. You know, some people are just not going to change their mind. They're in their political camp. I think tribalism, explains a lot of that. But for some people who really do want to know the truth, and maybe they're getting it from the wrong places, it's very hard for them to know when they're being lied to. And, you know, the politicians of many stripes contribute to that problem. So,
well, thank you, my friend Drew Harrell, Washington Post. Let's talk again, and we'll be back with a couple of fascinating writers when we return after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Pleasure to share the microphone with you, and we close out the hour with a couple of outstanding writers. And first up is Gabrielle Bluestone, a journalist and licensed attorney from New York. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, New York Observer, and many other publications. Emmy-nominated producer of Netflix's Fry and associate producer of Different Flowers, winner of the 2017 Kansas City Film Fest Festival Prize, a person with great significance in our world. And the book is Hype: How Scammers, Grifters, and Con Artists Are Taking Over the Internet and Why We're Following. And this kind of dovetails with the talk about fake news. Are we getting duped on the internet more than we know, Gabrielle?
Yes, I believe we are. And I think that the weirdest part about it, and what inspired me to write this book, is that you would think that given all the tools that we have on the internet, we would be more enabled as consumers to uncover these scams and to discover when people aren't telling us the truth. But my research has showed that we're actually even more primed to be duped than ever before.
How prominent is it?
Well, I think it's a combination of social media and the way that we use it. We're lied to every day, and it's on such a spectrum, whether it's by brands and corporations, politicians, or influencers. I mean, there's this entire new class of marketers who exist solely just to sell us things by showing us their lifestyles.
And the title of the book is Hype, and hype in its in and of itself is not necessarily a bad thing, but it can certainly be taken to a bad degree, can't it?
Yes. Well, the problem is, I think in today's day and age, we have all tacitly agreed to accept hype in lieu of the real thing. And so I think that encompasses the discussion you were having before about Donald Trump. I think it applies to, you know, the startup tech world that we have accepted, where companies like Uber are considered the gold standard despite never having turned a profit, which in turn enables people like Elizabeth Holmes of Theranos or Adam Neumann of WeWork to achieve similar acclaim without ever really having an underlying product. I really see it as all connected.
One of the people you single out is the person who made more money than anybody in the world last year, Elon Musk. You say he has manipulated us with hype. How did he do it?
Absolutely. Well, you know, what all these people have in common are that they are incredible marketers. Elon Musk has managed to turn a tunnel boring company into a futuristic hyperloop. He has managed to turn basically an advanced cruise control in Tesla into the forefront of self-driving cars. You know, what he is presenting to the world does not match what he actually, what the actual product is.
Barry in Mid-City. Barry, you're on with Gabrielle Bluestone. Hi, Barry. Please turn your radio down.
Good morning. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. What's your question?
I want to know, please, what an influencer is and how one becomes an influencer, please.
Okay. What is an influencer?
That's a great question. An influencer is someone who makes their money by presenting their lifestyle online and then intertwining ads in between their regular posts. And by selling their lifestyle, they are then able to sell products. What's interesting about influencers is that what their real value is isn't the way that they post or, you know, who they are exactly. It's who follows them and how many people. So people like the Kardashians, who have millions and millions of followers, they are making money off of all the eyeballs. If we all unfollowed them today, they would have no brand value anymore. And so if you want to be an influencer, you should have a very aesthetically beautiful Instagram profile that makes all the people around you jealous and ask you how to get that life.
Well, where is this heading, Gabrielle? Is it going to abate, or are we going to have more and more of this and perhaps become more victim than we are right now?
Unfortunately, I don't think it's heading anywhere good. I think that we have kind of passed that point. You know, one of the things that I found in the book in researching the rise of social media was when social media migrated from our computers to our cell phones, and everything changed once we were constantly connected, once it was always in our pockets. Now we're living in a world where, we follow all our friends on social media, but our friends are behaving like brands. Brands are behaving like our friends, and, you know, celebrities are in the mix as well. We can no longer tell, you know, what we know in real life from what is virtual, and I don't think we're trying all that hard.
Well, the book is Hype, How Scammers, Grifters, and Con Artists Are Taking Over the Internet and Why We're Following. Thank you, Gabrielle. An enlightening discussion. Appreciate you, and congrats on your book.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. And we're joined for a few moments from the great country of Israel by Inat Nathan, a parenting expert, public speaker, and best-selling author. Her book is My Everything, which is a number one bestseller in Israel. She holds a BA in law from Tel Aviv University. And I think it's Inat. I am sorry. I believe that's correct pronunciation. If not, please let me know.
No, it's a great pronunciation. Hi, Gene.
Okay,
thank you for
all right,
having
sweetheart.
Me.
Thank you for joining us. And you are a so-called parenting expert. How does one become such?
I've graduated the Adlerian Institute of Parenting, which took 6 years, and that's what I do for the last 19 years.
Well, it's a passion.
Except for parenting my own five children.
That's what I was going to say. You've done it five times, so you know a little bit about what you write, certainly more than I would know. The book is My Everything, The Parent I Want to Be, The Children I Hope to Raise. Reviewers call it a beautiful and comforting read that reminds mothers how to be patient with their children, how to remain calm in an age of constant fear-mongering, and to appreciate and accept each child as an individual in their own quirks, gifts, and flaws. Is it more difficult now to be a parent than it was a generation or two ago?
Oh, wow. It's a different world. I think that we live in a world where, you know, parents today have lost the tribe. You know, they don't just say it takes a village. So parents are much more isolated. As Gabrielle said before me, there is so much information, so much abundance of sources of accessible information. And they're mostly, you know, either the experts, where I personally always found that the know-it-all experts end up making parents feel bad, like there was something wrong with them or with their children. And there's the whole world of social media, like mommy bloggers or people who don't have authority but do share the struggles of being a parent. The thing about young parents or modern parents is that they get kind of lost. Because when they turn to the experts, they feel bad. And when they turn to social media, they either see this display of the perfect family, perfect life, perfect yoga-wearing skinny mom, or the struggling, bitter mom. And I thought to myself, if that's the case, what's the most effective way to give parents information they can really apply? And this is this book, I think.
What is the biggest obstacle right now in raising kids anywhere in the world?
I think the perfect picture, or letting go of the fantasy. You remember the fantasy?
Yeah.
Even when I throw parents back to the first pregnancy, there was this perfect picture of thoughts and images and what kind of parent I will be or what kind of children I would raise. That's the point where we usually look at other people's children and raise an eyebrow. Ours is not going to look like this, talk like this, and our partnership and our love is only going to grow and we'll sit comfortably around the dinner table and everything is going to be so harmonious. And the fantasy shatters so quickly, and it's leaving us with all the outside noise that is bothering parents today and interfering with the hard work of being a parent. So if a parent has to do his job and now is holding the perfect picture of how his child was supposed to be or how I was not supposed mm-hmm. to say the sentences that came out of my mother's mouth, and here we go, and here it is. And there's the Instagram and the perfect children of the perfect extension that, yeah, where do you have 5 hours? We can talk about it some more.
Well, you speak of a woman with 5 children who I hear all are doing well. The book is My Everything, The Parent I Want to Be, The Children I Hope to Raise. It was an overwhelming bestseller in Israel and is making its American debut and appropriate for Mother's Day. Inat Nathan, thank you for joining us today. It's been
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us from abroad, where it is approaching nightfall in Israel, one of the most wonderful places on the planet. And as we move along in the week to come, tomorrow, Sito Narcisse, the new superintendent of schools for East Baton Rouge Parish, is slated to be one of our guests. And for those who got a look at the census yesterday, Louisiana now has 4,657,757 people, gain of 2.74% from the last census, 25th in the nation. We are an average-sized state. 3 states in America lost population from the last census 10 years ago, and they are West Virginia, Mississippi, and Illinois. So Louisiana didn't gain as much as other states for the most part, but we did not lose population, and we did not lose a congressional seat. For the first time, California has lost one, now with 54 electoral votes. Texas gains 2, so the Lone Star State will have 40 electoral votes. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support. Until tomorrow, thank you for listening. Stay safe and stay tuned.